I don't give a fuck who fucking seen my Twitter. I don't give a fuck what the fuck you niggas is talking about, nigga. I'm not deleting shit, dog.
They tried to call me They forgot a real nigga don't need clout. They forgot I still got stripes, I ain't cashed out. They forgot that they ain't about what I'm about. They tried to call me out. They forgot a real nigga don't need clout. They forgot I still got stripes, I ain't cashed out. They forgot that they ain't about what I'm about. My own family turned on me. I was working, going crazy, losing sleep. Seeing things no one should ever have to see. Being things no one should ever have to be. I do wrong so we can eat. I starve now so we can feast. I stay up so y'all can sleep. You don't get that bitch, you weak. Every day it's a new problem, a new issue in these streets. So I keep these magazines. I flip through them, I don't read. Sucker niggas being sweet, tryna throw off my energy. The opposition pushing lines, unleashing my energy. My girl supposed to be my rock, but she acting real rocky. I swear it's me against the world, and they all trying to stop me. That's why I be shaking sometimes randomly, like, oh, get off me. I be killing petty niggas. If they could, they come home.
Nigga, if you would have been there tonight,
they tried to call me They forgot a real nigga don't need clout. They forgot I still got stripes, I ain't cashed out. They forgot that they ain't about what I'm about. They tried to call me
You just heard Clout by Raz Simone. Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this biweekly news, interviews, and commentary experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And if you want exclusive bonus content, become a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Right now, we're live on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. And we begin every show with news stories you might have missed, but should definitely be on your radar. So now, without further ado, the news. Our first story comes from OPB by Jonathan Levinson. It's titled, Portland Police Investigation Clears Officer Who Joined Oath Keepers Militia. According to Levinson, a Portland Police Bureau investigation concluded that one of its officers did not violate professional conduct directives when he joined the Oath Keepers in 2018. A month-long internal affairs investigation that concluded in December confirmed Officer Joseph Weber joined the militia. In an interview explaining his membership in the group, Weber told investigator Stacy Rovinelli that 2018, quote, was kind of hard times for law enforcement, unquote. He says, or quote, I heard they were pro-law enforcement, Weber told Rovinelli. So I looked at their website, nothing bad because I'm obviously like trying not to associate with anything bad. They looked okay. They were pro-constitution and things like that. Furthermore, according to Levinson, the Oath Keepers are an anti-government militia group founded in 2009 that recruits people with experience in law enforcement and the military to prepare for what the organization characterizes as an inevitable armed conflict with the U.S. government. The Oath Keepers have faced intense scrutiny for years because of extremist activity, but the attention reached a new height after the federal prosecutors alleged the group helped organize the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. This week, the U.S. House Committee investigating the attack revealed startling details about the group's efforts during the insurrection, including that they coordinated with the Proud Boys and Trump allies Roger Stone and Michael Flynn. Court records have also revealed the Oath Keepers brought explosives to D.C. prior to January 6th and staged an armed quick reaction force just outside the city. The investigation into Weber was prompted by an OPB investigation of leaked Oath Keepers membership data that revealed over two dozen current and former law enforcement officers in Oregon had joined the group since its founding. So further along the article, Levinson also details just several noteworthy Oath Keepers incidents, be it in 2010, 2014, multiple in 2016, again in 2017. where they made the news for violence, racism, some combination of both and more. But we saw this to say, white supremacist in the Portland Police Bureau. Shocking, 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 shocking. And yet, even less shocking that an investigation of the Portland Police Bureau's misconduct by the Portland Police Bureau found nothing was done wrong. Maybe the cops shouldn't be investigating themselves. Our next story comes from Oregon Live. It's by Zane Sparling. It's titled, Portland Man's Conviction for Killing Toddler Overturned After Prosecutors Excluded Black Jurors Due to Race. Sparling writes, in the ruling released Wednesday, presiding judge Josephine Mooney found that while Multnomah County Senior District Attorney Amanda Nadell offered race-neutral reasons to strike both prospective jurors, those arguments were only a pretext. Quote, racial discrimination in the selection of jurors is harmful, Mooney wrote. The state did not seek to strike similarly situated jurors who were not black. Further in the article writes, McWood's defense attorney at trial, Josephine Townsend, challenged both dismissals under the Batson rule, referring to a 1986 U.S. Supreme Court decision prohibiting the exclusion of prospective jurors based on their race. In an interview, Townsend noted that Nadell didn't use for-cause challenges to remove the two black jurors. For-cause challenges require evidence that the juror in question can't be impartial. Instead, both strikeouts proposed by Nadell were peremptory challenges, meaning the prosecutor didn't have to offer a rationale. After Townsend objected, Nadell raised various problems with the jurors' answers to questionnaires. Judge Christopher Marshall accepted both dismissals without commentary. So this is an important article about the nuts and bolts of the criminal justice system, specifically how jurors are struck down. You're supposed to be held amongst a jury of your peers. If you're a black man in Oregon, statistically, that's already hard enough. And if jurors are being struck because basically under the assumption that they're biased because they are black, that is further stacking the deck against you. And it's hard to get a fair trial. This case has happened to be overturned for the moment anyway. But again, it's important to note, one, what's happening in these courtrooms. It's not just the outcome, but it's the how and the details why. Up until, maybe this is still the case, I probably should research this before I got on air, but we're podcasting, so we do what we do. But I remember Oregon and Louisiana were the only states left that didn't need unanimous juries for convictions. That still might be the case, but it's one of those things where you can have holdouts and still get a system that disproportionately wrongfully convicts black and brown people. But this is another tool, simply making sure that the jury isn't of your peers. I'm not sure, if you've had the chance to be part of jury selection. I've only done it once, and I was struck because at the time I was asked about, my police experience, and, I said it wasn't positive, and that was an easy way to, strike me from that jury. As I've since, learned, you gotta be aware of these things if you want to be even involved in the process, because again, they're looking to pick you off pretty easily. So some food for thought, another story we'll keep our eyes on. Next story comes from Willamette Week. It's by Sophie Peel and it's titled, Survey of City Employees Shows Majority Would Look for Other Jobs If Asked to Work in Person More Than One Day a Week. Peel writes, the latest workplace survey conducted by the City of Portland shows that nearly 65% of city employees who responded would rather look for employment elsewhere than be required to come to the office more than 2 days per week. The figure shows in the report likely aren't welcome, or the figures shown in the report likely aren't welcome news to city officials who are looking to repopulate the downtown core after 2 years of pandemic gutted much of its foot traffic. Among the survey's takeaways, it appears few employees saw frequenting downtown businesses as a priority for them. Quote, there is overwhelming sentiment that while city employees enjoy playing a part in the vibrant citywide economy, workplace decisions should not be based on that possibility, the survey reads. Respondents, by and large, said that they should not be placed in the position of being seen as a vehicle for economic stimulus, as many of them have their own financial issues as well, unquote. One respondent shared in their survey comments, staff feel they're being used as a political tool. What is told to staff is that to return to the office is about collaboration, but the politicians are saying that the city employees are helping bring life back to downtown and helping businesses, which many staff members feel should not be the driving factor. Other topics touched on by the survey include concerns about workplace and downtown safety, concerns about COVID-19 outbreaks and microaggressions experienced by people of color and LGBTQIA plus employees. So this story presents an interesting dynamic where it's funny, I was just at a wedding in California, and you know, it's not just here where people are talking about the plight of Portland or, you know, the images of downtown specifically. So it shouldn't be surprising that there is a push to get more people out here working, because if you're working down here, you're gonna go get coffee down here. You're going to go get lunch down here. You're more likely to bring business to the businesses or patronize the businesses out here. However, a lot of city employees seem to have caught on that that's essentially using them and putting them at, you know, risk of their own safety or at risk of other things. It talks about microaggressions in the workplace and other things like that, where, you know, it's no secret that people are moving away from, you know, working on site, especially if there's no, you know, direct need to. There's a real pushback. People are leaving their jobs. And when you hear these stats that, you know, 65% would choose something else if they have to work on site more than 2 days a week, you know, the incentives of, well, you could revitalize downtown are clearly not enough. You know, if we're not actually paying people, we're not giving people proper benefits, we're not giving people, like, actually incentives for their direct lives to put themselves at risk, it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that we're not just going to, you know, bow to being tools to stimulate the economy. So hopefully, so far it doesn't seem like businesses are taking that cue, or that, you know, federal government, local government is taking that cue. But at some point, we got to support the people that make this stuff run. It can't just be a one-way street. And that's the news.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer. But will I defend the prequels? Yes.
If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. If you're familiar with this B-block, you're probably familiar with the segment we do every now and then called Hotep or Ferengi.
Woo!
Which, you know, was inspired by a certain section of the Black manosphere that's become more pronounced, at least in the media or social media spaces anyway in the last few years. And a lot of that was spurred by a man by the name of Kevin Samuels. So, you know, he got really famous for coining the phrase, we'll say, of high value man. What makes a high value man?
Yes.
And as you may have heard, Kevin Samuels recently passed the age of 50 something. And, you know, while my first inclination was, ooh, we got to do a Hotep or Ferengi because this is, you know, a moment when the, you know, the avatar
yeah,
for the Hotep side of that and kind of the Ferengi side of that, you know, has passed. But we also, like, I don't necessarily believe in karma, but not really big on just like, you know, really going in and making fun of the dead. Mm-hmm. You know, these people do have families, and just in general, again,
yeah,
the energy you put out there is the energy you get back. I just said I don't believe in karma, and that probably contradicts all of that. Anyways, that said, I do want to have a little bit of a discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, we are both Black men, and there's been a lot of discussion online about the influence of the Black manosphere.
Yes.
So a number of creators, I think we both follow, like FD Signifier, for example, you know, more popular video essayists on YouTube right now, has been doing a series kind of dissecting the manosphere. Kim Foster, who runs For Harriet, has been doing a number of discussions, not just on the manosphere, but specifically on this idea of, is the manosphere as influential as we say it is, or is it being inflated by the reaction to it, specifically from sort of feminist thinkers on the internet? And, you know, again, as two Black men who, I don't think either one of us are, were you a big Kevin Samuels watcher?
Not at all, no.
No, me neither. I don't watch Kevin Samuels. I don't watch. You know, we're not going to, I was about to name off and rattle off some people, but they don't need free promotion.
Yeah.
But what I will say, though, is that this idea that, you know, it's just a fringe thing and it's only being talked about because people are reacting to it, I don't think that's true.
No, that is not true.
We definitely come across people, you know, some of them are more, you know, overt, very, very Hotep-y, but then other people you wouldn't necessarily expect.
It's much more subtle.
Who are definitely like, they are following all this content, they're keeping up with it, even if they're like, well, you know, the line you, some version of the line you hear is like, well, it does have some points. You know, Kevin Samuels does have some points. And he's just being honest with these people. Why do you have a problem with him being honest with people? And it's like,
always rough. Yep.
You know, this whole, if honesty is just, you know, talking about basically like a woman has this place, if you're trying to attract this woman and you're trying to do all these things as a man, you've better hit these, you better be making this much money.
Yeah.
Better be doing this, that, or, and to be fair, like, he got a lot of attention for how he put down Black women, and all that criticism is deserved. But also, you know, he was an equal opportunity offender in just ruining Black men as well.
Yes.
You know, he really covered the bases of Black men and women and tearing down collective self-esteem. So, you know, good on him for that legacy, I guess. And there are plenty following or people who, you know, paved the way before him.
Yes.
Who are still very much chugging along today. But that said, I do think it is interesting to explore this idea of like, is the influence as big as we say it is? Because, you know, there are reasons why this content is popular. From the standpoint of the algorithm, it's just, you know, it causes an emotional reaction. And obviously, like, the algorithm boosts things that, you know, you have a very visceral reaction to, anger especially. So things that are causing debate, things that piss you off, yeah, the algorithm is probably going to boost that.
Yes.
Things that, you know, denigrate minority groups, for some reason the algorithm has a way of pushing that.
Yes.
Like sexism, homophobia, racism,
transphobia, the whole transphobia, 360. Yeah.
But then also, if we're being real, like, one of the things that these, like, manosphere people are speaking to is the fact that society does reward certain performances of masculinity.
Yes.
Like, physical appearance, how much money you're making, mm-hmm. you know, your ability to, quote unquote, dominate in spaces. Mm-hmm. Whether we like to admit it or not, we do reward that in society.
We do. We
reward Absolutely. That in men. We, you know, your ability, like, if you are looking for a mate, especially if you're, you know, a straight man looking for a woman, like, we have kind of set that up in a way where it's like we do reward that, or we do validate these notions. So if you're a guy and you're feeling like, you know, you are not getting everything the world is rewarding you, and especially during this time where, in addition to, like, those social constructs, there's also just the economic factor where a lot of people are struggling.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like Kevin Samuels and this manosphere stuff, the same way I shouldn't say this manosphere, but, like, the Black manosphere speaks to people the same way the larger, you know, manosphere, and particularly the white manosphere speaks to people in the same yes. way it's radicalizing a lot of white men and boys out mm-hmm. here to be just the worst. Like, that is very much tied to the fact that people are struggling out here.
Yeah.
And when they're struggling, again, they gravitate towards those things that can scapegoat people and say, it's not your fault. It's these women's fault. It's society's fault. It's the minorities who are taking your jobs and your opportunities. Obviously, it's still worrisome because, again,
yeah.
it feels pretty transparent, but it is getting a lot of people, and it is, you know, we use this word radicalizing, but mm-hmm. I look at it especially from a standpoint of, just again, as Black men, like, people I know who don't watch that stuff, but, you know, if we're having a talk and they start seeming to repeat, or at least, like, start alluding to those lines about, you know, what a Black man should be.
Mm.
Or taking a step further, like, you know, taking a, like, the way people talk about school curriculum, or, like, limiting, you know, expression in school, or, like, feeling like I'm not the too much, too fast stuff in school mm-hmm. from people who you would think are, like, otherwise progressive.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I'm seeing the intersections. Like, it's not just the Black man list. I'm seeing how, like, a bunch of, like, Tucker Carlson, Fox News type stuff is also kind of, like, coming through that pipeline yep. to you. And it's like, what do we do about this? Because it's one thing to just look at it and say, that's them over there. I don't watch that. So mm-hmm. what does it matter? But it's clearly affecting people. It's clearly playing on, you know, established tropes and ideas. And if nothing else, just from, like, a selfish standpoint, like, the way women, non-binary people in particular, see me as a Black man ends up being also shaped
yes.
by these people's, like, outsized Absolutely. Influence in society. Like, uh-huh. I don't know about you, but do you feel like, when you go out now, like, you got to be, like, I got to put on for Black men that much more because... otherwise, people are just going to assume I'm, you know...
one of the... it,
yeah.
It's so difficult because I think in... it's really interesting because, like, I feel like I've noticed the manosphere conversation more recently, more than I have ever in my life. But I think it's existed for a long period, if not all of my life, like, the concept of the manosphere. And I think what's really difficult, especially when it comes to the topic of Black men, is that we are already viewed as aggressive and angry figures and hard-headed figures in society. So when the negative connotation of now you have Black men in media looking super ignorant and being super unaccepting, and you have a lot of Black men who are following this, like so many Black men refuse to acknowledge trans lives in general. Like so many Black men are still extremely homophobic. Even like, it was really interesting. I don't know how this crossed over to you. I'm a believer of like a lot of people in communities. I'm a listen to the community and how they feel about issues. And I don't know if you listened to the recent Kendrick Lamar issue or album, but his use of the F word on the album made a lot of people in the queer community uncomfortable. I don't think anyone was trying to cancel Kendrick Lamar, but I noticed a lot of like, especially Black men being like, nah, but this wasn't for you. Like this was made for us. Da, 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 da. And mm-hmm. It's like, but you're not the ones who are made uncomfortable by this moment. It's not your job to be uncomfortable. It is as of our job, again. And like, that's like, again, no one's trying to cancel Kendrick. We still love Kendrick. But I think in that, when those are the images that are being seen from the mass majority of public Black figures and like all of that, I think, yeah, it does kind of make it difficult to move around, or like I feel to even be viewed as a comfortable figure for people around me. And this is as someone who has a lot of queer people in my life and all of that. Like, I think I do feel like I have to do not extra, because I don't think it's being extra, but I do think that it's like, I have to be very aware of like how I'm moving because like of these people and these figures who are doing insane, crazy shit around us.
Oh, that's right though. Like in a lot of cases, you know, you see this, and part of this also, this massive reaction is just to having to acknowledge, especially like queer people
mm-hmm.
in a way that you didn't have to do like in the 90s, or at least like publicly anyway. Yeah. And see this pushback, you see just like, this is like vitriol and like not even very low-key hatred. And like, it's one thing for us to like look at like a Kevin Samuels or these other commentators and be like, oh, that's just this corner of the internet over here, whatever. But yeah, like you said, we start talking about Kendrick Lamar, mm-hmm. we start talking about more, you know, I think more like even like overt just expressions of transphobia with like a Dave Chappelle or yes. someone. Like, it's very, very much mainstream figures putting out stuff that, you know, a lot of people are consuming. I mean, I got into, let's see, you know, talk about Bruce's stories here. It's like, I got into a little argument with a friend of mine, with a trans friend of mine, over the Dave Chappelle special. Mm-hmm. Not over, like, I wasn't defending Dave, but just over my choice, like, to watch it, period.
Yeah.
And I understood their point of saying, like, okay, you're hearing these things about the special, so why are you going to watch it?
Mm-hmm.
And my stance at the time was like, okay, like, I just want to know what is actually, I want this in, like, context, and I want to know what's being said. And,
yeah. You
know, I watched it, and I was like, yikes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one point, for those who haven't seen the closer, you know, there's a point where Dave brings up North Carolina's like trans exclusion laws with like, or like banning trans people from like the bathroom laws. And he's actually trying to, like, he's trying to make a point about how like it's a mean-spirited law,
mm-hmm.
but someone in the audience is like, as soon as he mentions the law, like starts like cheering for it. And you know, he has a moment, he has to pause and be like, no, it's a mean law, something like that.
Yeah. Right?
And it's like an obvious parallel for the story he talks about of why he quit the Chappelle show.
Yes.
Where he talks about, you know, doing this blackface pixie skit and someone laughing the wrong way and him just feeling uncomfortable. But in this moment with the closer, like, he acknowledges, hey, no, you're laughing at the wrong thing, but then continues on and is very much since double, triple, quadruple down.
Yes. On,
like, even to the point where he got attacked by a person on stage who ended up having, like, I think it was actually like a knife, legitimately, like, didn't pull it out on him, but like legitimately, like, tackled him, attacked him, and they whooped that guy's.
Yeah.
But that's another story. I didn't hear, and I found out in a clip later, is like, when he got up from that, the first thing he says is like something along the lines of, I think a trans person tried to attack me. And it's like, wow, we are like, what are we doing here? It's just all this stuff that, again, we're like doubling and tripling down on just the most, you know, some of the more like overtly like bigoted views, and just these things that, again, have been, you know, tropes, to be fair, of what we just define as traditional masculinity, really hyper masculinity. Mm-hmm. What do you do about that when it's, because again, like we talked about earlier, it's kind of, that's, it's held a traditional space in pop culture, and the algorithm definitely boosts that type of content because of how it affects people's emotions and what kind of engagement it draws. But, you know, as Black men who I'd like to think are trying to do better in this world, like, what is the response to that? Because, like, we can make, you know, more thoughtful content out here. And there are obviously people, we mentioned FD Signify earlier, were doing this and getting numbers toward it. But for the most part, you know, the market is not designed to boost you if you do this. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, they're going to write you off as just trying to be, you know, too woke or all this other stuff, trying to do this. At the same time, like, we do have an obligation, not just from a media standpoint, but, you know, if you do any, you know, work with students, going in here, you know, looking at middle schoolers and high schoolers and thinking, okay, they're watching what we're doing. You know, how do we make sure this stuff is imparted and it's not just, you know, imparted through like the language they put in, you know, a school manual or something, like, this is how we're going to do, and we're going to do an assembly on this. But like how do we model being better humans in a real way, both in the media and in life, in a world where this type of content, this manosphere content, is so outsized and so designed to be outsized in the media landscape. Like, I wish I had the answers.
That is,
part of my inclination is to like look at it from a media standpoint, be like, well, what can we put on screen to change these things? But the reality is, we're trying to change a way of thinking. We're trying to change a way of how we're socialized. So it goes deeper, and it means solutions that are long. Solutions that are, you know, like I said,
time consuming.
Exactly. Time consuming, emotionally challenging, things that are really going to make you grow. And you may not see, it until 5 years later, being real.
Yeah.
But considering the scope of the problem, I'd say these actions are also necessary.
Agreed. 100%.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for my newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates.
Hello, hello, y'all. It's Ado once again. Here to let you know that this is part two of the interview with AJ McCurry. But even this isn't the full interview. There's some parts that are missing because it was a really big and informative interview. So if you want to catch all of that, y'all saw the commercial earlier. Follow Bruce Poinsett on Patreon where you can support and you'll get to see the full interview because you're missing a lot of really cool things that AJ is saying. But nevertheless, here's the rest of the interview.
But do you think it'd be fair to say that, you know, being again, that you've been, grew up in Portland, but you've also lived in other places. And can you just talk about, like, what were those other places?
So I briefly lived outside of DC as a teenager, and that was a very different, and partly like the thing that I noticed about living in that part of the country, it's very transitional. And so people come and go relatively quickly around administrations, around like DC jobs mm-hmm. that have a very different expiration date. So the way that they build community there is very different. I went to college in New Orleans and then I went back down there with my kid, and New Orleans is I lived there pre-Katrina and post-Katrina. It builds community in a very different way. And city pride is something that like Portland just could really take a lesson in. I do say that, like, particularly living in New Orleans and in the Deep South, I've also lived in Texas, really has impacted like the way that I think about building and intentionality. New Orleans is such an interesting place. You have to experience it. I don't even know how to, like, I'm not the person to explain like community and like the collective there. But what I can tell you about, like, when I moved from New Orleans with my child, we literally spent a day and a half going to all of these different businesses and different places just to let them know that we're not dying, that we were just moving. So we went to all like these just places that we frequented regularly, both in our neighborhood and just throughout the city. And it was like something I knew I intentionally had to do. We did not go back to New Orleans for like 2 years. And then we went and we were there for like 2 weeks. And I kid you not, this happened more than once. We were walking down the street, and we did live in the French Quarter for a chunk of time, which was like a dream of mine and was a really magical experience. And New Orleans is way more than just Mardi Gras and boobs. It is. It's way more than that. We were walking down the street, and my child is, you know, kids grow, right? He's 2 years older, bigger, looks different. I have people that ran out of their shop. Is that AJ and Hobbs? Is that? And I was like, y'all remember? Like, we haven't been here in 2 years. I didn't write you a letter or anything, but like, that is the way that community is. We were there's a place called the Kate Cafe, and I'd worked right by there for a good amount of time. And when I say we went in there just like to get a little cupcake, because they do have these amazing cupcakes. If you're in New Orleans, go to the Kate Cafe in the Marigny. When I tell you, the entire back came out to say hi to us and like marvel at how much my child had grown. Like, it was the most. To this, I still get chills. Like, the community building is so intentional, and people, I will say part of it is just like a slower model there, right? Like, people can take just a minute to say hi. We in Portland, like, we talk about that we're this liberal, progressive, small business place, but we won't look each other in the eye and say hi. We want things to happen and exist, but then we're too lazy, too busy, too tired, whatever, to show up. And the big difference that I know about New Orleans is the concept of you have to be in community to have community is not lost there. Here in Portland, we struggle with that reality. Like, to have community, you have to be in community. And to be in community means that you have community. It means you cannot have community just from your phone, from Instagram or Facebook. And I'm not knocking social media, because it is a very amazing, helpful tool. But we actually have to be around each other and build and regularly contribute and regularly show up. And that is something that really we're struggling with here in Portland. And I mean, it's just a very different intentionality. Like, I will use Mardi Gras parades, right? So I lived on a parade route for a while off of St. Charles. In my balcony, you could see the parade. So we live in the prime place for that, you know, to parade, and parades are a big deal during Mardi Gras. And during Mardi Gras, you become friends with whoever you're parading next to. So we would go to St. Charles, but you could see my apartment. The amount of people that I brought into my home, strangers, complete strangers. You would never do this in Portland. This is just, people were like, you lost your mind? I literally would bring, you know, tons of different like other people into my home so they could use a bathroom because it was right there. Oh, you gotta come on, bring your kid, whatever. Do you need some water? Do you need a minute to sit down? Like, it's fine. Like, I ended up watching a parade on my balcony with this mom and her little kids because they were overwhelmed, but like one kid didn't want to leave, and you know, and I was like, well, you can like nurse up here. We can chill. Like, it's totally fine and safe. We can see the parade. Had a great time. It's a very different sense of like community and connectivity, and it's intentional there. I still am in contact with people that I have met as a bartender in New Orleans and at parades. on social media. That we like regularly talk. They're like, I just, you know, donated to some kids, like, I don't know, summer camp thing from a relationship that was just like we paraded together. So it's, I think it's very different here. We are, somebody once told me that Portland reminds them of, I've never been to like Sweden or Denmark or any of those Scandinavian countries. But they're like, we really have that kind of isolated, kind of distant vibe. And I see that. Like, it's not, I mean, we talk a good game, but like, we really struggle. So, I mean, living away has informed how I organized in a lot of ways. Yeah.
It's interesting, especially when you talk about this idea of just like actually slowing down to build community. It's something that I think about always, you know, after it could have been helpful, you know, just something goes wrong after some, you know, some petty little dispute breaks out or something, like, you know, it would have been nice to have, you know, sometime before just sat down, actually established what we're trying to do. And, you know, and even beyond that, actually taking some time to not do the business and actually like build some relationships and some trust with people.
I mean, that's anti the way that business operates right now in real time, though. So it's like what we're fighting against, right? Like, we always hear, like, I want, like, people are like, I want a relationship. I'm like, my business is relationship building or my business is transactional. I don't think we like fundamentally understand these terms, you know, like, even a transactional relationship should be relationship building, especially if you're in business and if you want to stay in business, whatever it is that you're doing. And if also clear communication makes a difference in how that actually can translate into real life. But that slowdown part, most of us are not willing to, as a collective, slow down.
Strange with, it's like Oregon, because it feels like there's a lot of opportunities like to do that. And I've gotten into like hiking recently and some of these other things where it's like,
how is that?
I enjoy it.
You have the shoes and everything.
Oh yeah, I got
the shoes and the backpack and like.
I don't do the backpack. Oh, okay. I got the boots. I got my water and just go. But I will say it's been good because, like, most of the hiking I do is usually with other people. So it's like, it's a time to just like talk and, again, just kind of like build relationships, you know, come up with a lot of bad pilot ideas or very good pilot ideas, depending on who you ask. But that's a other story entirely. What I will say, though, is just, again, I feel like Oregon with the weather, with, like, hiking stuff, be like other, you know, activities, being, you know, a coffee place and all this. It's like, we have the means and we have sort of the things that are conducive to actually like slowing down if we wanted to.
We just do. A big if,
but.
But it's an intentional tap in, right? Like, it's an intentional, everybody has to tap in. Like, what would our society look like if everybody intentionally was like, okay, and this is everybody who is, if you have rode in an Uber in the last 6 weeks, if you have ordered from Uber Eats, you know, Grubhub or whatever, DoorDash, if you have ordered something off of Amazon, I am talking to you. If you have done anything that sort of went to happy hour, went out to eat, you have a little small amount of expendable cash. If everybody who tapped into those services was like, all right, I'm going to maybe not order Uber Eats one time. I'm going to intentionally walk or take the bus and use those like $50 that they spent on some of these luxuries and put that $50, just $50 of everybody, put that, like, I'm going to put $20 into mutual aid. I'm going to put $15 into, you know, community, like to a nonprofit or something, a regular nonprofit that I vibe with. And I want to spend the other amount of money to a kid that's in college. I'm just going to regularly just send them this little $20 or whatever. we would see this massive amount of change, but it would be everybody has to tap in to do that. And it's the same with like, if everybody was like, I'm going to intentionally one Saturday a month for 2 years, I'm going to commit to 2 years before I switch to another thing. One Saturday a month, I'm going to volunteer. I'm going to show up and give back. And maybe volunteering, maybe you have a weird work schedule, so volunteering for you is going to have to look like you're just picking up trash in your neighborhood. But if everybody can like really intentionally committed to that, we would see these massive shifts everywhere. And it's like really simple things that all of us, if we tapped into, like if everybody that's like on some of these apps was like, okay, I could do $50 and I could do 3 hours, one day a month, we would see a whole transformation in the way that we live, the exist, and what's being funded and who's supported. Because people don't realize like how much like $10 from, you know, 1,000 people, that adds up really fast. You know, if 5 people intentionally were sending a college student, you know, $25 a month, that's going to be transformational in their experience at college and their stress. I don't think a lot of people even realize how many college students are just like on the verge, or they are hungry because they don't have enough money. I mean, I lived off of grapes and ramen when I was in college. It's definitely not great for an active mind. So anybody, if you know college students, Venmo them $20 today. Just dinner's on me. You know, just be intentional in that way. Like that, it's literally that much effort if we all tapped in. And this is not like new information. People have been saying this, and everybody who's right now up in arms about Roe versus Wade, who's up in arms about the EPA, who's up in arms about, and I can't even remember all of the insane things the Supreme Court's just done recently, intentionally tapped in these like little ways. We would see a whole different society in like 6 weeks. Like you can't just be mad about it on Twitter. Like you actually have to intentionally participate, and participation doesn't mean quitting your day job and like being like doing something really insane and intense and complicated. It could literally just be like, I'm gonna just, without even talking about it, Venmoing a college student regularly. I'm gonna pick up trash in my neighborhood. I'm gonna go like intentionally go to the school in my neighborhood's auction because it's a fundraiser. Like, and the amount of people that are not dialed in, tapped in, is the problem. Like, we've got 800,000 people in Portland, and, you know, 600,000 of them too busy to vote. I'm not even talking about the folks that are not registered to vote. Like, we got to touch base with them and work on that. But, like, something that, like, literally impacts our taxes, our how we function as individuals, you can't, you know. So it's like if we all intentionally tapped in just a teeny bit, we would have this incredible different experience. And we saw a little taste of that with, like, the way that mutual aid popped off and, like, really kind of got this resurgence, you know, of interest and power during the pandemic. We need to, like, bring that energy back.
AJ, thank you again for, you know, being so generous with your time and your insights today. Before we let you go, can you just tell people if they want to, you know, learn more or support Equitable Giving Circle, where they can go, and, you know, any news or updates
that
people should know about?
Please check us out at equitablegivingcircle.org. Again, that's equitablegivingcircle.org. Find us on social media. We are on Instagram and Facebook and a very neglected Twitter. Make a donation, one-time donation or a monthly donation. Any amount helps significantly. It is a big deal. And we are in the process right now of trying to buy a building. So all dollars are really helpful in that, in us buying a building. We are going to put this building in a trust and be very, it's going to be it's a really exciting transformational way of like building a nonprofit and this resource in the community. Check us out. Come volunteer. We are needing volunteers Tuesdays through Saturdays generally, and need everything from drivers to folks helping with social media and fundraising. We have a pantry every Thursday that's open to our Black and Brown community. Right now it's at Alder Commons on 42nd and Fremont. And it happens Thursdays from 10 to 2. So come by, get some fresh produce. I'm also, this is like me stuff that's not EGC. I am launching a fundraising cohort. So I'm teaching other folks to fundraise later this month. So hit me up directly. And next month I'm having, this is the first for me in a very long time, curating an art show at the Oregon Contemporary Center of the Arts, celebrating Black motherhood. So yeah, lots of stuff that I'm always doing all of the things. And if you need to volunteer, not just at EGC, I've got, you know, Race Talks needs volunteers, Steps PDX needs volunteers, Mom Block needs volunteers. I know other organizations that also need volunteers. So hit me up. I'm always trying to build community in this, you know, tattered world we live in.
Awesome. Well, yeah. AJ, thank you again. And
yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day and good luck. And
thank you.
Thing with all the work you're doing.
It is an adventure.
And this has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, Black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.